Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 430, The First Refuge of a Scoundrel, being recorded on October 20th of 2003. There'll be a detailed, annotated description of For the Record Program Number 430 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. It's strongly recommended that listeners who are going to disseminate this information take advantage of these long descriptions on the Spitfire website in the For the Record section, again, at spitfirelist.com. The heroic WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older For the Record programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the Spitfire website as well. The most recent pair of half-hour segments is available for download only on the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website for about a week or so after the initial recording of the program. Now, in the concluding element to Side 1, we took a look at links between, not only the historical links between fascist elements and elements of the Hindu nationalist movement, which are in ascendance in India, but we also took a look at the role of a former RSS member, that is the reactionary Hindu nationalist organization that is sort of the parent of current manifestations, in the role of a former RSS member in the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. I'm going to review a little bit of the historical background for purposes of refreshing people's memory, or not refreshing people's memory, but from the article Hindu Fundamentalism, Why We Are Concerned, by Paul Crofts and Anjona Roy from the Searchlight magazine, January of 2003, we read, during the 1940s, the RSS's new leader, Madhav Golwalkar, following the death of RSS founder Keshav Balram Hejuwar, sympathized both with German Nazism and Italian fascism. In 1939, Golwalkar said, quote, German race pride has now become the topic of the day. To keep up the purity of the race and its culture, Germany shocked the world by purging the country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifest here. Germany has shown how well-nigh impossible it is for races and cultures having differences going to the root to be assimilated into one united whole, a good lesson for Hindustan to learn and profit by. And that's from Mr. Golwalkar in We Our Nationhood Defined. Now, as I noted, one of the ironies is that, and it's not really irony, but in terms of getting past some of the more superficial and virulent manifestations of the contemporary political landscape, one should understand that what is represented as matters of religion or the spirit or God are anything but, and that, in fact, religion is being abused. And again, if patriotism could said to be the last refuge of a scoundrel, religion is usually the first. Now, the Hindu nationalists are ranged in a deadly and, who knows, potentially world-ending conflict that has at least the potential to go nuclear in the confrontation over Kashmir. On the other side, we have Islamic fundamentalists in Pakistan, strongly entrenched within the within Pakistani society, although the current president of Pakistan is opposed to them. Among the influences on the Pakistani Islamic fundamentalists are the Wahhabis, and beyond that, the Muslim Brothers, some of whose connections to the P2 milieu we took a look at in Side 1. Now, by way of once again underscoring that what is really at work here is politics, and that the fascist and reactionary politics transcend religious, ethnic, and nationalist divides, and that what one is really looking at is fascism and not religion, we're going to take a look at yet another article by the brilliant Kevin Coogan, this also from the Oracle Syndicate website. I have not read this article in the past on the air. We've talked about Ahmed Huber, the German and Islamist neo-Nazi, one of the directors of the Alpacua Network, an individual with very strong connections to various fascist elements. Ahmed Huber, nay, Armand Huber, is a devout Muslim, but he also is a fascist and someone with very strong links, operational links, to an organization called the Avalon Gemeinschaft, or Avalon Society, and we're going to take a look at that right now. Again, my use of Kevin Coogan's material does not imply endorsement by Mr. Coogan for any of the working hypotheses I present on this program. This particular article, originally a sidebar in Hit List magazine from April and May of 2002, is called Ahmed Huber, the Avalon Gemeinschaft, and the Swiss New Right. It's available from the OracleSyndicate.org website. And what's interesting to note here is that Ahmed Huber, in addition to being a Muslim fundamentalist and a neo-Nazi, is, or perhaps as a result of some of his associations with fascist and New Right elements, Ahmed Huber is closely associated with the Avalon Gemeinschaft, which is a New Right, or some would say neo-fascist or proto-fascist organization, which is at a philosophical level and operational level, very closely associated with European neo-paganism. And as we're going to read in this essay, it is explicitly opposed to monotheism. And one should note here again that what we're looking at is politics, not religion. We're looking at politics masquerading as religion. A serious Muslim would view Ahmed Huber's dalliance here with great distaste. It might even be enough to get to Ahmed Huber classified as a heretic within more traditional Muslim more traditional elements of Muslim philosophy. Let's take a look at Ahmed Huber, devout Muslim, but also an associate of an anti-Muslim neo-pagan slash fascist network, the Avalon Gemeinschaft. This article reads in part as follows. Ahmed Huber is not only a devout Muslim and supporter of political Islam, he also is a leading member of the avowedly pagan Swiss-based Avalon Gemeinschaft, or Avalon Society, also known as the Avalon Kreis or Avalon Circle. Avalon's estimated 150 members, including aging Swiss SS volunteers, youthful far-right fanatics, and dyed-in-the-wool Holocaust deniers. Each summer solstice, this motley melange of characters journeys deep into the Swiss woods to ritually worship the pre-Christian Celtic gods of ancient Europe. They then spend the rest of the year bemoaning the Enlightenment and denying the Holocaust. Although Huber is one of Avalon's leading members, he was not involved in founding the group. Avalon began as a curious mixture of old right and new right currents that reflected its founding members' involvement in a far-right youth group known as the Viking Jugendschweiz, or WJS, as well as their later rejection of cadre-based politics for the creation of Avalon as a self-proclaimed elite society. Besides being steeped in mystical imagery, Avalon's founders also embraced New Right jargon, most frequently associated with the French theorist Alain de Benoist, his Paris-based think tank Grece, G-R-E-C-E, and Grece's German counterpart Pierre Krebs' Thule Seminar. Skipping down in this essay, after talking about the founding of the seed for the Avalon Gemeinschaft, which was the Vikingjugend Deutschland, we skip ahead and we read in a section titled The Birth of the Avalon Gemeinschaft. Following the official dissolution of the WJS, that's the Vikingjugend Schweiz, following the official dissolution of the WJS, Wüthrich, that's Roger Wüthrich, Wüthrich and another rightist named Andreas Grossfeiter decided to build a new elite cadre organization, the Avalon Gemeinschaft. They structured their new group on the new right model espoused by de Benoist and Grece in France and by Pierre Krebs in the Thule Seminar in Germany. Wüthrich and Grossfeiter's turned from a failed, cadre-based political activist model to a self-proclaimed elite structure did not occur out of the blue. The formation of the Avalon Gemeinschaft came after the Swiss far-right had learned about French and German New Right theory which primarily occurred through the activity of a young, Geneva-based writer named Pascal Junot. In 1983, Junot first established the Centre National de la Pensée Européenne with former members of the New European Order, or NEO-backed student group, the Nouvel Ordre Social, to help popularize new right ideas in Switzerland. 1 year later, Junot next established another Geneva-based organization, the Cercle Proudhon, in 1984. Junot also helped organize the Swiss branch of the Thule Seminar, while he also served as the Swiss correspondent for Gréche's journal Nouvelle École. In his book Strategie der kulturellen Revolution, Pierre Krebs, head of the Thule Seminar, gives a useful overview of the new right thinking when he embraces a theory of intellectual hegemony taken over from the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci and detorned by the new right. Krebs also articulated new right themes when he attacked the principle of equality, unquote, and instead demanded a war against egalitarianism and rootlessness, for originality and identity, against Americanism and collectivism, for culture and organic humanism. Race is class for a heterogeneous world of homogeneous peoples. Vive la différence! Starting in 1987, members of the Swiss branch of the Thule Seminar took part in a pagan gathering around the Celtic holiday Lugnasad, along with a delegation from the WJS and various neo-Nazis from across Europe. In 1988, the Swiss branch of the Thule Seminar, along with the Cercle Proudhon, organized seemingly scholarly-sounding talks on topics like the history of the Templars and the heritage of the Indo-Europeans on the grounds of Geneva University. Although lacking the scholarly chops of a Benoit or a Krebs, Avalon's founders were quick to proclaim their own elite status as well as their embrace of pagan ideas. Grossrider, for example, said that Avalon's members consider ourselves as an intellectual spiritual elite and know that our ideas are incomprehensible to simple people. Avalon's emergence also came wrapped in a heavy dose of Celtic mysticism. One Avalon tract began, "Avalon, white mist-covered island in an icy sea. Avalon, land of inner rest and the confident holy land of the Celts. Avalon, original homeland and secure pole of our European culture. The land of King Arthur gives our society its name. Many of our way and beliefs shall find the power in the circle to resist the timing of the wolf or the destruction of value. This is our spiritual place of refuge, the palace of the calling to mind of Europe's eternal values, courage, honor, and loyalty." Ahmed Huber's later emergence as a key Avalon leader no doubt reflects both his well-developed networking skills as well as his powerful contacts inside the European right. Huber's particular association with Avalon, however, may also be due in part to Avalon's new right trappings. New rightists are almost by definition extremely anti-American, and many look favorably on collaboration with the Islamic world. In traditional Islam, they see a culture that has resisted the siren song of the Enlightenment. Gréche leader Alain de Benoist, who has visited both Iran and Libya, also regularly criticizes Jean-Marie Le Pen's Front National for its harshly anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant views. That said, Avalon appears to be a rather poor copy of the Gréche model. The new right, it should be recalled, emerged in Paris in the late 1970s and early 1980s as a response not just to the cultural Americanization of Europe, but also as a reaction by a post-68 generation of young right-wing activists to the failed old right's tedious embrace of Hitler nostalgia and crude anti-Semitism. Against this, the new right reveled in rediscovering unorthodox theorists, particularly from the 1920s Conservative Revolution movement in Germany, thinkers like Carl Schmitt, Moder Vandenbroek, Ernst Niekisch, and Ernst Jünger. All of these men's ideas had either been highly marginalized or actively suppressed during the Nazi era. Under Huber and Vutrich, however, Avalon is far more close to intellectually spurious groups like the California-based Institute for Holocaust Review than with the elite Parisian salon world of de Benoit. That's also called the Institute for Historical Review. That is closely associated with the Liberty Lobby. Continuing. Still, Huber and Vutrich have tried to give Avalon some veneer of respectability. In March of 1998, for example, on the 200th anniversary of his death, Huber and other Avalon members laid a wreath at the memorial to General von Erlach, who was killed by Napoleon's troops in 1798. Erlach's death symbolized not just the end of Ben's Ancien Régime and the triumph of Napoleon's army, but the victory of the Enlightenment ideals of equality, democracy, and brotherhood associated with the French Revolution that both Avalon and the New Right so despise. By laying a wreath at Erlach's tomb, Huber and Avalon were suggesting that they were willing to fight once more to recapture a world once thought hopelessly vanished. Huber and Vutrich have also portrayed Avalon in a press communique as a highly respectable group that sponsors gatherings dedicated to scientific and cultural themes, particularly the honoring of Europe's Celtic-Germanic inheritance, as well as to groundbreaking critical research into questions of contemporary history. Avalon's eager embrace of Holocaust deniers, even more than its strange celebrations of the summer solstice, have stripped it of even a vague sense of legitimacy as a serious organization engaged in historical research. Avalon functions as a kind of umbrella organization for the Holocaust denial movement in Switzerland. Under the cover name of Studiengruppe für Geschichte, or History Study Group, for example, Avalon sponsored a 1993 presentation by leading French Holocaust denier Robert Faurisson at a hotel conference room in Bern. Some 70 people, including the NEO's Gaston Armand Amadruz, attended the gathering. Huber's close friend, Jürgen Graf, a leading Swiss Holocaust denier who is now living in Tehran, provided the simultaneous translation from French to German when Faurisson spoke. Robert H. Countess, an American editor of the Institute for Historical Review, also addressed the Avalon gathering in April of 1995. Huber's later participation, along with Graf and the German NPD's Horst Mahler in an IHR conference that was to have occurred in Beirut in the spring of 2001, can be seen as a logical extension of the kind of Holocaust denial activity that both Huber and Avalon have been involved with for years. Finally, it seems particularly ironic that a self-proclaimed Muslim like Huber would be associated at all with any New Right grouping, even with a pale parody of the New Right as Avalon appears to be. Huber, after all, is a self-proclaimed devotee of Islam, an utterly monotheistic religion. In the New Right canon, monotheism has always been portrayed as the original sin. This has been so ever since de Benoit identified the Enlightenment universalistic values as a secular extension of a monotheistic worldview, namely the Judeo-Christian tradition with which Islam claims to compete. New Right theorists insist that they embrace paganism and the pagan notion of a universe of pluralistic gods precisely out of their desire to dethrone monotheistic thought structures, which they see as essential to the future elimination of American monoculture. That a fanatical Islamic monotheist like Huber could spend each summer solstice out in the woods worshipping Celtic gods is one more bizarre twist to his already bizarre life. And again, if patriotism could be said to be the last refuge of a scoundrel, religion is usually the first. By the way, the Prime Minister of Serbia was Slobodan Milosevic. That's the individual over whose trial Per Felici Barki's law partner Carla Del Ponte is presiding. Barki is not only an attorney for Silvio Berlusconi, he's the attorney for Youssef Nada. In a number of programs, including For the Record 406, we took a look at the differences between Islam as it was preached by the Prophet Muhammad and Wahhabism. Islam is neither anti-Semitic nor anti-Christian, nor anti-woman, in particular the Hadith, the body of Islamic thought that supplements the Quran, clarifies that. We've clarified this. We've taken a look at that in FTR 362 and FTR 406. What we're going to do now is to take a look at a section of a long paper that was presented by Sheikh Professor Abdul Hadi Palazzi, the head imam of the Italian Muslim congregation. And this was presented at a conference that was sponsored by the Root and Branch Association. It's on the Loftus. It's on the website, rather, of John Loftus at johnloftus.com. And the first section of this essay is titled "Orthodox Islamic Perceptions of Jihad and Martyrdom." And I'm going to read a nice chunk of this essay by way of contrasting what Islamic fundamentalism or Islamism or Islamofascism, as I would characterize the philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, professes, and the reality of Islam as interpreted here by Sheikh Professor Abdul Hadi Palazzi. He writes, "My main goal is making a distinction between the traditional Islamic concepts of jihad and martyrdom and the distortion of those concepts made by radical movements which promote terrorism and claim to do so in the name of Islam. This distinction is obviously a more general aspect of a basic dualism and permits us to understand in detail the differences between Orthodox and traditional Islam on the one hand, the religion that was revealed by the Prophet Muhammad, and whose main sources are the Quran and the prophetic tradition, or Sunnah, and the contemporary ideology that is commonly referred to as Islamic fundamentalism. As a Muslim scholar, I must first of all remark that I cannot agree with this same definition so common in the contemporary media. As a matter of fact, I personally never deal with Islamic fundamentalism or Islamic radicalism, but rather with pseudo-Islamic radicalism. This depends on the fact that fundamentalism, unquote, is not a legitimate form of Islam, but an evident distortion of Islamic values, an attempt to change Islam from a religious tradition into a political totalitarian ideology. Some Muslim scholars, such as my friend and colleague, Professor Khalid Duran of Temple University of Philadelphia, mark the distinction between Orthodox Islamic doctrine and its political counterfeit by calling the former Islam and the latter Islamism. Quote, Professor Duran writes, quote, "Whether Islamists like the term fundamentalist or not, their understanding of religion resembles that of fundamentalists in other religions. This is not to say that Islamists are more religious or more genuinely Islamic than other Muslims. A common misunderstanding in the West has it that Islamists are the 100%ers among Muslims and that they are the people of tradition. This is not at all the case. Islamists have a problem with the people of tradition, especially the Sufis or mystics. Islamism is a late 20th century totalitarianism. It follows in the wake of fascism and communism, picking up from those and seeking to refine their methods of domination. Islamists mold tradition so as to serve their political ends. This causes them to clash with traditionalist Muslims who resist this manipulation of religion for power politics. Islamism is not a reaction of people feeling a loss of religious meaning, but a reaction to a sense of loss in the political sphere. It is a quest of power, an attempt to conquer the state, not to regain independence for religion, least of all individual faith. Like most totalitarian ideologies, Islamism is a utopianism. Islamists seek to dominate by the most advanced technologies. In that sense, they are modernists. But their model for an ideal society takes inspiration from an idealized 7th century Arabia and an ahistorical view of religion and human development, and an ahistorical view of religion and human development in general. It is an anachronistic mode of thinking in conflict with modern concepts of democracy, pluralism, and human rights. A relevant difference between traditional or orthodox Islam and Islamism is in the way of understanding the link between religion and politics. Few Muslims would deny that political commitment is a part of Islamic ethics, but most disagree with the Islamist insistence that there exists a clearly defined Islamic system different from all other political systems. Islamists refuse to accept a secular state that puts a majority of a non-Muslim puts a member of a non-Muslim minority at par with a member of the Muslim majority, and a woman at par with man. According to traditional Islamic theology, prophets are sent among human beings to teach them some necessary truths about the nature of God, about ethics, and about those actions and those omissions which cause prosperity in this world and beatitude in the hereafter. It can sometimes happen that those prophets are called to preach in a milieu where a state and a complex social organization does not exist at all, and this causes them to assume a role of political leadership. This was, for instance, the role of Moses as a leader of the children of Israel in the Exodus from Egypt, or the position of Muhammad as a governor of the state centered in Medina. Even so, Islamic orthodoxy teaches that this happens per accident, and political leadership is not among the necessary elements of the prophetic mastership. As a matter of fact, the Quran uses different titles to describe the Prophet Muhammad, but none of these titles refers to a political function. The Quran says that Muhammad has been sent as an admonisher, as a warner, as someone who calls to God as a shining light, but it never says that he was sent as a political leader or as a head of state. Islamists, on the contrary, have a completely opposite attitude. According to their point of view, the diffusion of Islam cannot be separated from the creation of a claimed Islamic state. The role of Muslim scholars is immediately confused with the role of leaders of a political movement or party. Islamists continuously repeat that Islam is both religion and government. This is the basic description of their creed. What they forget to underline is that those words, Islam is both religion and government, are neither found in the Holy Quran, Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, or in ancient authoritative Islamic sources. As a matter of fact, this slogan, Al-Islam Dinwa Dawala, was coined by Taqi ed-Din ibn Tamayyah, a scholar who lived during the 13th and 14th centuries CE, and who was condemned to life imprisonment for his numerous heresies. Those who repeat Ibn Taymiyyah's slogan, Islam is religion and government, are the same ones, for instance, who deal with the liberation of Jerusalem from the hands of the Jews, unquote. Unfortunately for them, the heretic Ibn Taymiyyah, from whom they make their slogan, is the same one who strongly denies any special role of Jerusalem in Islam. Ibn Taymiyyah openly writes, quote, "There is no Muslim holy place in Jerusalem," unquote, but his followers claim to fight for the liberation of Jerusalem in the name of Ibn Taymiyyah. Ibn Taymiyyah openly writes, "There is no Muslim holy place in Jerusalem," but his followers claim to fight for the liberation of Jerusalem in the name of Ibn Taymiyyah. It is a clear example of how Islamism is a confused ideology wherein contradictions are dealt with by silence. While many Western researchers are inclined to describe Islamism as a form of resurgence of Islam, Muslim traditional scholars see its appearance as a symptom of secularization, as a reshaping of our religion as a modern ideological totalitarianism. This is especially evident in the Islamist deformation of the role of jihad. In the original meaning, jihad is not limited to the military field, but generally means striving hard toward a goal. According to some sayings of the Prophet Muhammad that are contained in the compilation called Sahih al-Bukhari, delivery is the jihad of a woman, while the jihad of someone who has old parents is taking care of them. The military jihad was not a form of expansion of the religion by means of the sword, but a form of defense against religious persecution. And this paper then goes on to describe in considerable detail the perversion of the concept of jihad by the Islamists. There has been no shortage of perversion of religion. We've seen a recent proclamation by Indonesia of the Jewish conspiracy theory. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad subscribed to that. We've also seen Pat Robertson, the self-proclaimed, quote, Christian, unquote, advocating nuking the State Department, once again illustrating that if patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, Religion is usually the first. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 430, The First Refuge of a Scoundrel, being recorded on October 20th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.